Coming up on this week's book show, Eric Larson is known for expertly transporting readers to past worlds. Even stories we think we know come to life in a different way in his hands. His latest, The Splendid and the Vile, takes us into the heart of war-torn England for the period of May 10, 1940 to May 10, 1941, Winston Churchill's first year as Prime Minister. Eric Larson on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Eric Larson is the author of the bestsellers Dead Wake, In the Garden of Beasts, Thunderstruck, The Devil in the White City, and Isaac Storm. They have collectively sold more than 9 million copies. Larson is known for expertly transporting readers to past worlds. Even stories we think we know come to life in a different way in his hands. His latest, The Splendid and the Vile, takes us into the heart of war-torn England for the period of May 10, 1940 through May 10, 1941, Winston Churchill's first year as Prime Minister. The book is an intimate account of how Churchill and his inner circle went about surviving on a daily basis during the year when Churchill became Churchill, the cigar-smoking bulldog that we all think we know. Again, the new book is The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. And it's a pleasure to welcome Eric Larson to this week's book show.
Thank you for having me again.
Give us a sense at what point you came to wanting to tell the story about this particular year in Churchill's life.
The story actually begins in Seattle, where I used to live. We had packed our three daughters off to college and decided, okay, we're gonna move to Manhattan. And when we moved to the city, this is about 5 years ago, I had this sort of an epiphany. I realized, and this may fall into the duh category, but it was not that way for me. I realized that a resident of New York on 9/11 had a very different experience than I had in Seattle watching the whole horrific saga unfold on CNN. In New York, people heard the sirens, saw the smoke, and above all, experienced that sense of violation of having their city, their home, attacked by outsiders. And I started thinking, one thing led to another, and I started thinking, you know, what would it have been like then to have been in London during the worst of the German bombing campaign when, you know, really there were 57 consecutive 9/11s in a row. And for 6 months after that, at intervals, an intensifying series of air raids. I started wondering, how does anybody cope with that situation? And I thought, you know, this might make an interesting thing to look at. So I considered first just writing about a typical London family. And then I started thinking about Churchill and, you know, sort of the quintessential Londoner. I mean, how on earth did he do it as the new prime minister dealing with directing his half of a world war? And, you know, still had to survive the day-by-day trauma of this relentless bombing. And so that's really how I got into it. It wasn't so much the first year that drew me. It is actually the fact that it is, as happens so rarely for a writer of nonfiction, it was a very neatly compartmentalized narrative because Churchill became prime minister on May 10, 1940. And on May 10, 1941, the major German air campaign essentially came to an end. There were resurgences later on, but that was a sort of a neatly compartmented period. And also two other elements of the narrative also came to a conclusion on May 10th, which is like, that's like a writer's dream.
There's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end.
There's an end, and not only just an end, but when everything sort of comes together at the end with this sort of Vonnegutian clamor.
So you have 57 consecutive nights of bombing. That's followed by this series of nighttime raids over the next 6 months. So right. It's really unrelenting.
It's unrelenting. And actually, the 57 consecutive nights, initially there were daytime raids, but the Germans knew enough to switch to nighttime because the RAF was too effective at taking out bombers. But the interesting thing is, you know, the Blitz, we do think of the Blitz as that 57-night period. But make no mistake, the air war, the campaign against London and against Britain continued with intensifying pressure for another 6 months.
You said as a moment ago that you were less interested in that first year as you were about the events of what was going on, that it coincided with this bombing campaign. But certainly in this country, we look at the first 100 days of an administration and we put a lot of import in that. We certainly see a leader emerge here and transform and become what we know.
Yes, surely that's the case. In this first year, he truly does become the Churchill that we all think we know. He did his best speeches. He showed the world how heroic he was, and it was transformative.
Ultimately, the question, which you seem to look to answer many times in the book, is how you endure an ordeal like that over
right.
and over and over.
Yeah, again, that was the motivating question for me. I mean, for example, one always as a writer brings one's personal experience to a story, and I am the father, as I mentioned, I'm a father of three daughters, and my daughters accuse me of being the king of anxiety because I'm always concerned about, you know, do they have smoke detectors in their apartments, you know, do they wear their seatbelts? What about their boyfriends? You know, all those sort of quotidian anxieties that we fathers tend to have. Then you sort of transpose all that to a period like these 57 nights of bombing in London, and you are a father, which Churchill was. His youngest living daughter was 17 at the time, Mary Churchill. You have your family and your wife. You know, how do you deal with all that as well as run the affairs of state?
And you tell this story through these day-to-day experiences of what it is like to deal with the family, to deal with the inner circle, to deal with what was going on day after day.
Right, right. Well, for example, one of my favorite characters, well, actually my most favorite character in the book is, in fact, Mary Churchill. I was granted permission to read and use her diary by her daughter, Emma Soames. It was tremendously revealing in terms of how life was led during that period, and also how Mary's parents, Winston and Clementine, how they treated her, how they kept her at first sequestered in the prime ministerial country home Chequers or at her friend Judy Montague's country house Breckles. And she chafed at this. She really wanted to come back to London and be part of the war. Of course, at the same time, she was also really enjoying herself because she went to lots of parties with RAF pilots. There was a certain amount of, as she put it, snogging in the hayloft. so there was a real insight into how life went on and also, you know, how one, at least in this case, how her parents managed to try to keep her out of the war, at least for a while.
Is there an immediate, in reading that diary, do you see an immediate understanding by her of what is happening to Winston Churchill?
Yes. One of the things that I found really endearing about Mary's diary was, first of all, her sheer adoration of her father comes through at a number of places. I mean, she felt very keenly whenever he came under criticism, whenever he was under pressure. And that's really a very sweet element of the diary. I would hope that my own daughters with their diaries would be doing something similar, but I don't know.
But an understanding of the time and the place, and also, as you say, that life also goes on.
Right, right. I mean, I think we know that intuitively, but what I was really struck by was the extent to which not only did life go on, but people seemed to thrive in the crevices between the intensive bombings. Again, I come back to Mary and her friends. They would go out dancing, partying. During the day, the shopping districts of London were packed. That's after the raids became nighttime raids. So life definitely went on. People went to films, concerts, and so forth, but there were all kinds of interesting little wrinkles. For example, when you came to work in the morning on your train, and people did continue to commute to London, when you came to work in the morning on your train, you brought your gas mask with you.
Right.
And people also started wearing little identity discs just in case they got blown to bits, which was a very real possibility.
Eric Larson is our guest. The name of the new book is The Splendid and the Vile. It is published by Crown. I love the word vile. Where does that come from?
So the title, Splendid and Vile, comes from an entry in another diary. This was a diary kept by John Colville, who was one of Churchill's cadre of private secretaries. He kept a wonderful, detailed, day-to-day diary, exquisitely well-written. An illegal diary, by the way. He was not supposed to be keeping this diary because he worked for the prime minister, and you know, had some Nazi agent gotten a hold of it, it would have been a treasure trove of insights into Churchill and into operational details. But one of these entries involved what Colville made after observing a particularly intense air raid from the window of a bedroom. He watched this raid unfold, and he was struck by the weird juxtaposition, the beauty, the spectacle of the dark night, bombs, flames, searchlights, and all. The juxtaposition between the sort of the beauty, the splendor of the night, and also what it said about, as he put it, human vileness. Mm. And when I read that passage right there, I thought, yeah, that's going to be my title, The Splendid and the Vile.
You spoke a moment ago of looking at these and watching these raids. This is something that they would do, right? They would go and watch and see and fully take in what was happening to their city.
Well, this is what another thing that stood out about Winston Churchill was that, you know, he really was fearless. And he was very much aware of the symbolic power of fearless acts. So when raids occurred, he would more than likely, he would go to the roof of the nearest building and watch, if you can imagine that. And he would drag him, you know, staff with him or visitors. And that was a very important part, actually, of how he managed to rally Britain in this really awful time, by demonstrating to the people of the city and of the country that you got to carry on and just be courageous.
Colville writes at one point, and I'm hoping you can set it up, sort of go of what you say in the book is the last line of the chapter, which is entitled The Ghosts of Dull People. That night in his diary, Colville wrote, "It was at once the most dramatic and the most fantastic evening I have ever spent." Again, sort of the splendid and the vile, but give us the setup to what led him to write those words.
Yeah, he was writing about one of the many nights that Churchill spent at this prime ministerial estate, Chequers. You know, once he became prime minister on May 10th, 1940, the house was his to use. It was given to the government for use, exclusive use by prime ministers, by a very generous donor. The rule governing the house actually was supposed to be that no work was to be done. This was a place to recharge so that prime ministers could sort of maintain their mental health. Now, Churchill, of course, being Churchill, he turned it into his sort of second headquarters. The house was full of every weekend, full of guests, some who came. The expression was you came to dine, to sleep, or to dine and sleep. There were various guests doing all those things. And one of these nights was Colville had the great privilege of being the duty private secretary at Chequers and attended the dinner as a full-fledged participant. And he was just awed by the, you know, really the majesty of the affair, you know, the high-level conversations, the booze. I mean, these were wonderful dinners.
What access did you have to not only those diaries, but to others? And what it would seem to me there would be no more powerful tool than that.
Yeah, diaries are incredibly powerful in terms of looking at this time. And there were many that I used for the research for this book. You know, another was by a fellow named Harold Nicholson, also an exquisite writer. He was in the Ministry of Churchill's Ministry of Information. He was a very talented writer, a real acute observer of what was going on around him. And so that diary in particular provided all kinds of insights. Another fantastic diary was by an American, General Raymond Lee, who was an American military observer in London. And he, too, had the gift of prose. He wrote a very detailed daily diary with long, detailed passages about what was going on around him. And this, too, was incredibly valuable. People were clearly aware that this was a monumental moment in history and that it needed to be carefully recorded.
While all of this is going on, you make a point in the book to underline just how fun Winston Churchill could be.
Yeah, that was one of the most startling things, I think, to me, or most surprising about Churchill as I got into the research. He was really a lot of fun. He had a great sense of humor. He had no sense of vanity. He loved to sing along with gramophone records. His favorite songs were, you know, Run, Rabbit, Run, Run, Run. He loved songs from The Wizard of Oz. And he loved Gilbert and Sullivan. One of my favorite scenes is when Churchill at Chequers, he's dressed at this point in his blue siren suit, which is essentially a one-piece pull-on outfit that he designed. The idea being that, you know, if the need arose, he was able to just pull it on quickly. This is referred to as a siren suit. And it was pale blue. So he's wearing his pale blue siren suit, but he's also wearing his garish gold silk dressing gown. He's also carrying a Mannlicher rifle with a bayonet and proceeds to do bayonet drills to the strains of martial music from the gramophone as guests for that particular day look on, just doubled over with laughter at this prime minister who is quite serious about getting the drills correct.
The way you tell the story over this year is fascinating. The book has several parts. But one of the things that fascinated me is just, and this is a writing question, you can have typical chapters, but there are also very, very short chapters too, aren't there?
Yeah. Well, I'm a big believer in texture in writing. I think there's nothing more tedious than a series of uniform length chapters. My favorite thing is to have, ordinary length chapters, maybe 10 pages or so. I really try to avoid very long chapters. And then at intervals, I'll space them with quite short chapters. Maybe there's some particularly important element of the story that I want to weave in at a particular point, and that becomes, in some cases, simply a one-page chapter, or even a one-paragraph chapter, or even a one, five stanza excerpt from a diary. Mm-hmm. I just think it's very, very helpful for texture and pace.
And you mentioned pace. It does give it a page-turner quality to it.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad.
When you think of these wonderful characters that are throughout this story and throughout this book with Churchill at the top, do you ever worry that it becomes too Churchill-centric or that all of these characters get their due as well?
You know, I think if anything, what I've tried to do is acknowledge that scholars in this world of Churchill have tended to engage in a kind of hagiography, making Churchill the saint of this whole era, and one can sometimes come away with the impression that Churchill single-handedly won the war. What I set out to do was really to show, one of the things that I set out to do is to show that to the extent to which he actually relied quite heavily on his closest advisors. This was his secret circle, which included John Colville's private secretary and included his family. But you know, he did not fight this war alone. He really relied on the people around him.
So that was never a challenge for you then to make sure that he didn't get too much of the page?
You know, it's always a balancing act, though. You know, he is the crucial ingredient. But no, I think, as with any sort of writing, with any writing project, you know, you want to get the right balance, and you strive for that, and that's what the editing phase is all about. I mean, honestly, this book weighs in now at about 500 pages, but when I've finished the first reasonably coherent draft, it was at least twice as long. And that's actually the way I like it, because my rule of thumb is I like to have twice as much material, twice as much of a draft than I really need, because then you can engage in the editing process. And that's the most vital, well, not the most vital, but that is an incredibly vital phase of writing any book.
You write the German perspective as well here.
Yes, I felt that was very important to show as a counterpoint what was going on in terms of German thinking about Churchill, about the Blitz, about England, about Britain as this defiant foe. So yeah, there are elements involving Hitler, Joseph Goebbels. A lot, relatively speaking, involving Hermann Göring, who was the chief of the Luftwaffe. I felt that the German story was quite important, and not actually just in terms of informing, but frankly, from a writerly perspective, it was also, I think, very important in terms of building and maintaining suspense. Because, you know, if you know what the Germans are thinking, and you know that they're planning some vast, you know, some gigantic raid, and Churchill and company don't know it yet, well, there's an element of suspense there.
Certainly. I know the last time we were together, we did a stage event in Vermont for your last book. And
yeah, I remember it fondly, yes.
It was a wonderful night. And one of the things that you said was, and you alluded to it earlier, about finding, of narrowing the story down and finding that lens. At what point do you know that you have the right lens? Do you play with different lenses to say, oh, this is what will work for me and for this story?
Well, in this case, the lens, in effect, began the process. This idea of, like, my lens was, you know, through which to view the, you know, the historical record. My lens was, you know, how could anybody survive this, and specifically, how could Churchill survive this relentless bombing campaign by the Germans? So that was my lens. And what I've found time and again is that when you have a particular lens, you know, I wasn't setting out to do a biography. I don't think I will ever do a biography. But when you have a particular lens, you look at the historical record differently than, say, another writer who was pursuing something else would look at it, for example, a biographer. And that's where I think I was actually able to find quite a bit that was fresh and new and revealing about Churchill in that first year. And believe me, I don't say that lightly, because to be able to say anything new about Churchill is really sort of I'm going to pat myself on the back here, is really kind of an accomplishment. There's so much written about him.
And yet, because of that lens and looking at that one year and at what was happening and having that overarching question of how did he endure this, I assume you put blinders on to everything else, and including everything else that's been written about him and the movies and the TV shows and everything else.
Well, yeah, you raise a very important point. Well, first of all, one of the things that I did from the beginning was I vowed that I would not watch any video representation by an actor of Churchill, because I didn't want that image running through my head during the whole process. It can really skew how you look at the historical record. Also, what I decided early on was, because there was so much material that had been done about Churchill, I realized that look, if I set out, in an ideal world, I would love to have read everything ever written about Churchill before I started this project. But, you know, this is not an ideal world. To do so would take a decade. And even at that point, I wouldn't be finished because every year more books come out. So I decided to zig when, in fact, when perhaps common sense would have said to zag. And I read into the canon to a degree. I read a couple of biographies. I read enough material, already published material, so that I understood the landscape, the various events that occurred in the course of that year, the underlying forces. But then my goal was, having done that, to jump right into the primary materials, jump right into the archives, and then deploy my lens to look at this material that maybe others had gone through, I don't know. But because I'm looking for particular things, or at least things that I will recognize when I see them, suddenly I'm being able to find and say things that are reasonably fresh.
In the epilogue of the book, which is titled As Time Went By, you bring us up to date, right? Because otherwise the story ends in 1941, and obviously there's much more that happens.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I love epilogues, honestly. I like the recessional feeling of explaining what happened to people, not everything that happened to them, because then you'd have a series of biographies at the end and this epilogue would go on forever. But, you know, what I tried to do is just bring out a couple of key things about each important character that kind of rounded that character out as history advanced, especially Churchill, you know, who of course went on from 1941 until 1945 as prime minister for a time, this ever darkening war, and then, you know, paradoxically in 1945, before the war was actually concluded, was thrown out of office. These things are very important to know. But my main emphasis is on, in the epilogue, is on finding and conveying some element, some revelatory element about the characters involved that perhaps leaves readers with just a little bit of delight or feeling moved by something.
When you are finished with a project like this, do you want to go in a completely different time frame, a different century, a different... what do you think of what is next?
Well, when I finish a project like this, I mean, like any book, I mean, what I would really love is to be able to start my next book right away. But it has never happened. The process of finding the next book takes me about, honestly, between the time I finish a book and the time I actually begin or actually propose the next book is typically about a year. And I wish it would be shorter. My agent wishes it would be shorter. So does my editor. But I really wish I could, but I can't. It's not like I never want to do another book about this period. I doubt it, though I'll ever do another book about Churchill. But I go where the story is. I mean, if somehow in the next tomorrow, an idea occurred to me that takes place in exactly this time period, I'd do it. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Eric Larson's latest is The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. The book is published by Crown. Eric Larson, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.